expression. This is the common state of man. This is the Eastern fable, the simple little story which brings a tremendous fact home, whereas a thousand words would not be as good as this one picture. But we are all, to a degree, like this old man, firmly believing that it is our sovereign right to carry the horse. We have always done it. We have carried the body as we would the horse. We have never assumed that we should ride it. We have never assumed that it should serve us. Its pleasure becomes our law and our necessity. But sometime, some way, man must learn to break the horse. As in the Taoist analogy or the Zen analogy of the 10 bulls, we must gradually achieve victory over this animal personality, which has become the heartless taskmaster, the absolute autocrat of our living. If, however, we finally can break the horse by one real and strenuous effort, we then come into a close camaraderie with the horse, and the well-trained horse is perhaps happier and more fortunate than in any other condition. Its friendship for the man who has mastered it becomes real and enduring. And yet, when it was broken, it fought for its liberty with everything that it had. In the same way, the human being, coming into a rational relationship with body, does not destroy body, but enriches it, gives it purpose, gives it fulfillment, gives it wisdom and care that the body will never have while the body alone attempts to dictate its own future. So man, in meditation, is, so to say, in the Zen allegory, learning to ride his own horse. He is learning the simple relationships between consciousness and body. And he is finally learning that these relationships can be pleasant, that they can be better, more happy, and that every factor involved is improved as a result of this achievement. But whereas breaking the horse is a symbol of a very violent action, the Zen discipline is violent only in terms of how we would think it to be. We can't imagine any exertion greater than self-control. And we assume that we must gather ourselves up and become dragon slayers in order to overcome our own temperaments. Thus the achievement seems incredible. But actually, in meditation, we find it extremely simple. It is quite simple to let go. In fact, we let go every night when we go to sleep. And if we do not let go, we have a bad night. Thus, in sleep, we peacefully, happily, and optimistically give up our prejudices, our hates, our fears, and our doubts, and rest ourselves in the comfort of comparative not knowing, fully convinced that in the morning we will wake up with fresh energy with which to make new mistakes. Meditation is therefore a kind of waking sleep. It is the individual attaining freedom without unconsciousness, gaining the power to rest without first blocking every faculty of his consciousness in order to do so. This is not necessary. Man can rest awake. He can rest with his consciousness quietly and smoothly functioning. He can also suspend these functions almost totally until, with this effortless effort, the individual can experience the mystery of passing through what the old Zen calls the gateless gate, the door between two states of being that is no door at all, but is simply quietude. For in the quietude, the individual experiences this understanding, this inner mystery of meditation. And as the Lord walked in the garden in the cool of the evening, so in the quiet coolness of the collected light, man becomes aware. He is not even dogmatically interested in what he becomes aware of. He is not demanding awareness of this belief or proof for that idea. In meditation, he is simply accepting. He is permitting the infinite to move in its own infinite way. And this is a very wonderful experience. Now, some people make their mistakes, as this book points out, in trying to meditate morning, noon, and night. This is not the purpose of the discipline. The purpose of this discipline is that the individual shall have interludes. Perhaps very brief interludes. Interludes which become a dynamic kind of prayer. We do not necessarily feel that we must pray from morning till night, because we know in our better philosophy that our own conduct, hour by hour, is a continual living prayer, if it is right. But for a few moments, 5-10 minutes a day, we seek this re-identification with the essential fact. And through this identification, we have the courage. We have the quiet sense of value by which we can live the rest of the time with a good hope, with understanding, with tranquility and peace, and also with a higher measure of conduct because we have experienced beyond our previous state. So it is this quietude which simply lets the universe move through us, react upon us. But it is not negative because it asks nothing. It demands nothing. It does not make itself an open hole in space. It simply relaxes personal tension in order that impersonal value may arise in consciousness and be accessible to us at any time. We are not seeking communion with the dead. We are seeking communion with the life that is within us. And out of this communion is our hope of additional strength and integrity. Now, the second of our disciplines that we mention here is the discipline of realization. Now, the very word realization means or implies something more active. To realize something is to suddenly become aware of it. Or realization may mean awareness of values that we have not previously known or recognized. Or realization of better meaning than we have formally held to be associated with an idea, a circumstance, or an object. In our discussion, we mention realization here is the simultaneous understanding and acceptance of the divinity and the divine purpose in all things. The acceptance of the things as they are. But now, this is not merely quietude. It is acceptance in a sense, but it is a process of acceptance. The individual has the right to accept or reject. And acceptance now is a kind of highly suspended activity. It is an activity by which we make a moral choice or a decision involving value. We are constantly confronted with ideas which we either accept or reject. We are constantly in the presence of values which we weigh and analyze. But what we are trying to do with the discipline of realization is to become aware of meaning, to become aware constantly of our own power to ascertain or to penetrate into meaning. Realization, perhaps in its simplest form, is our ability to rise above the tendency to accept appearances or to judge things only from their surfaces and their outward parts. Realization also is a very wonderful thing in education, inasmuch as it becomes a natural hunger for meaning. So that instead of thinking of dates and places and wars and generals and statesmen, realization seeks to arrange these elements to discover value. What are the meanings? What have we learned? What has the world gained? What has human consciousness experienced through these various vicissitudes of life? Therefore, history becomes valuable as a record of the unfolding of energy content, the direction of human decision, the pressures that have influenced mankind. Realization, therefore, is forever seeking meaning. Thus, this exercise can be somewhat more broadly diversified and applied at other times. Realization should become an automatic, ever-present help in time of trouble. Realization is the remedy for superficial reaction to circumstance. Realization causes also things that seemingly are only annoyances or interruptions or trivialities to suddenly indicate meaning. And realization, of course, has a tendency to reduce our tendency to condemn, to criticize, to reject. It ends this highly Aristotelian polarization of so and not so. It causes us to be more patient, more considerate, and to search under action for its motives, for its lesson for us. The end of realization, therefore, as a technique, may be that we survey all existence and ask ourselves the simple question, what does this mean to me? How will it help me to grow? And how will it help me to become a better servant of the need of mankind? A better parent, a better husband, a better friend. How will it help me to guard against the intrusion of false opinion by which I may be deceived or deceive others and thus open my way to the most serious and unhappy consequences? Realization deepens. It also takes the edge off of unreasonable action. The more we realize, the less dogmatic we are, the less aggressive we are. Therefore, many people in the West feel that this is a poor exercise, inasmuch as it takes away the sharpness of our own willingness to live and die for what we think. But unfortunately, up to now, we have only died for what we think, and the living part has not been especially favorable. So in this realization, then, we seek value, and the ultimate realization is, of course, the realization of the imminence of a divine plan, that all things that appear and manifest themselves exist only because they have a root in an eternal reality. Therefore, in some way, by their manifestation, by their expression, they reveal something of that which we can know. Science accepts certain measure of this in its doctrine of definitions by which we come to know things by what they do. And if we are able to use the realization principle accurately, phenomena in all its forms reveals its own noumenal source. And when we see something, we become aware of the processes behind it, rather than the mere object itself. Realization, then, is the experiencing through of the illusion of appearances and the subtle, instinctive questioning and questing of the realities which lie beneath all things as they seem to be. Thus, we are really using certain faculties of our own. We are not simply depending. We are questing. And realization is a rather suspended but motivated, constant searching for the divine in the universe. And if we have this mood, not aggressively, we're not out seeking God every minute. We are not seeking God in the sense of a being or a person at all. We are seeking the God principle as it is manifested through the God working, not only in our friend, but in our enemy. Not only in the people we like, but the people we have never known. It helps us, therefore, to have a better orientation. And realization is this constantly sustained, natural inquiry after truth. And if we can develop it, it will do us a great deal of good. Illumination is the third subject of definition here. And we say that it is a state of conscious at-one-ment with universal principle, man's participation in truth. Illumination, therefore, is something which the individual cannot condition by his own efforts. Man may build toward reality. He may pass through a series of disciplines by which he brings himself, perhaps according to his own estimation, into a highly adjusted state. But in this problem, his own estimation is unimportant. For when man approaches the quality of illumination, he must become completely dependent upon the eternal workings of divine law itself. The hour no man knoweth. The individual cannot judge for the infinite. He cannot determine to what degree his own path has been correctly walked. He can only take faith in certain sincerities, dedications, and in the realization that he is following a path where many others have gone before him, that the end of this path has always been at-one-ment, an experience of participation in the identity of the divine nature. This experience comes, as Behme, the German mystic, says, like a flash of lightning, perhaps even in a clear sky. It is a sufficient situation, having set itself by all the means in our power and means that are not in our power. And when the hour is right, when the condition is right, when the being is right, when the adjustments which we have attained are perhaps as perfect as we think they are, when everything is as it should be, there is this experience of participation in total value. The individual suddenly becomes at one with life. Obviously, an experience of this kind is handicapped or limited by the bodily dimension. Man's human body is not an instrument suited for such highly attenuated experience. Even the most subtle parts of the body, the brain and the nervous system, are not able to sustain this vibratory rate for any length of time. The window must open and close. The light must come, perhaps only in the instant, as in the flash of light in the closing and opening of a camera shutter. Yet in this instant, there is a total existence. And in this mystical experience, or illumination, the individual becomes immediately aware of an eternal fact. The vision ceases, the heavens close, the light is darkened. But man can never forget that which he has actually experienced. All report and testimony can be ignored, but that which is experienced is inevitably fixed in consciousness. Thus illumination, as Plotinus tells us, may be granted to a person only once in a lifetime, or perhaps not in this lifetime at all. Yet in its own readiness and in its own time, it becomes the final proof of the validity of discipline. It becomes the end toward which all discipline leads, namely a total state of being capable of bearing the conscious experience of truth. This total state may be consumed in a few instants. We cannot sustain it. But this continuity is unimportant, because once the total experience has flashed upon us, no other situation can ever take away its validity. Illumination, then, is the natural end of mystical disciplines. But it is an end which must not be selfishly sought. It is an end that is self-working. And that which attempts to attain it will probably forever bar it. But that which deserves it by the doing of other things will attain it in proper time. In a way, it is a little like happiness. The more we seek it, the more rapidly it escapes. But when we forget ourselves in doing other things that are right, we suddenly discover that we are happy. And in this discovery of spiritual happiness, spiritual identity, which we call the cosmic experience or cosmic consciousness, we achieve that which we have earned. And probably by the time we achieve it, we may have given up all hope of ever having it. But regardless of this, in our merit, nothing which we deserve can be kept from us. But nothing we do not yet deserve can be bestowed upon us, either by our enthusiasm or our determination. All of these disciplines, therefore, have a common factor of relaxation, a common factor of acceptances, and a common dedication to the great spiritual truth that it is not our will, but the will of heaven that must be accomplished. Otherwise, nothing is accomplished. On another page of the work, in the first chapter also, there is a discussion of the problem of loneliness. We have an idea that the individual who starts out to be spiritual is gradually going to end up friendless. We also have a feeling that spirituality is going to have a terrible cost, that we must pay for being good by giving up everything we like, that some way, the way to God is a way of continuous sacrifice. Western man has made a fetish out of sacrifice. He has made it seem as though our eternal salvation in the world to come is dependent upon our continuing misery in this sphere. Such an attitude is obviously ridiculous, but it is still very strongly impressive. It gives us the concept that we must serve God by being miserable. Nature does not tell us this. Examples of life in other spheres of experience will not sustain such a concept. We cannot say that a flower is miserable because it grows, or a bird can only sing if it is tortured. These things are not true. Growth and life and unfoldment are the natural things of nature. Certainly, all growth has certain growing pains. These pains are pains of adjustment. But it is not growth per se that must lead to misery. It is man's interpretation of growth. It is a traditional point of view that has been built into his subconscious until he believes that through self-sacrifice, misery, resignation to disaster, he is really developing a godly nature. Actually, loneliness, or the sense of aloneness in our search for greater experience of truth, is due to certain deficiencies in ourselves. Actually, we are alone if our allegiances are divided. The individual who wants a condition which he has partly outgrown, but also wants a better condition which he has not yet attained, can be on the horns of a dilemma. Mostly we find the so-called unhappiness attendant upon efforts to improve simply due to wrong method. The individual has forgotten that growth is a reasonable process. He's trying too hard. He is trying to be too critical of his own conduct. He is making himself do things he does not really want to do. Or he is half-heartedly dedicated to some nobler concept of life. This type of situation is quite prevalent among organizations in which the membership, derived from many sources, may be united in a common purpose. But the individuals making up the memberships have different degrees of growth and allegiance. And in trying to keep the rules of their fraternity, they become utterly unadjusted and miserable because these rules are not really for them at this particular time. The person who finds that growth is making him uncomfortable is simply not ready for that kind of growth or else he is under wrong instruction. What he must realize is that growth is not the spearheading of a single virtue. It is not the individual trying very hard to attain some one thing and leaving the rest of his nature utterly uncultured. That is why we make such an emphasis here, perhaps more than some people think is necessary, of the importance of cultural growth along with other endeavors. The person who tries to be overwhelmingly good, moving desperately to what he believes to be a spiritual state, will usually be in trouble. He's in trouble because he has no supporting instruments. He wants to be very, very good, and yet most of his appetites are still bound to another kind of life. Now, he is not a sinner because he has these older attachments. He is simply uncomfortable because he has not adequately outgrown them. He is trying to cast them off without ever having actually transmuted them in his own conduct. So if we find that we're getting antisocial, if we can't get along with people, and one of the most common complaints that comes to me on this is typical of it, namely that it's more and more difficult, as one person and 100 more like them have pointed out to me, it's so difficult for the spiritual person to get along in this horrible materialistic atmosphere. People are just not suitable for friends. They don't have the same lofty instincts. They don't have the same spiritual interests. And this goes on and on and on until we can soon understand why the individual is totally alone. No one wants to hear this any longer. This is not true spirituality and never can be. It was pointed out to us in the New Testament that Jesus lived in the homes and ate and worked with the sinner and the unregenerate. It isn't necessary for the individual to feel that he's alone in the world simply because he has achieved a certain sense of smug internal spiritual achievement and is therefore a little better clay, or perhaps not clay, but a little better psychic integration than those around him. This is foolish. It will naturally make us very uncomfortable because it is nothing but metaphysical snobbery at best. The simple fact is that realization will teach us, as Emerson learned in a very simple manner, that there isn't a human being in the world who cannot teach us something. We don't outgrow other people. What we must outgrow is our own tendency to try to put them on levels of consciousness beneath our own. Work with them, understand them, share their interests, and you may discover that they will bring into focus neglected phases of your own experience. And the real level of our understanding we meet not merely upon the level of this desperate effort to be spiritual. We meet upon the common natural effort to be better. Therefore, cultural achievement is very important. As we love music, as we love art, as we express our refinements through appreciation for the good in others, for their achievements, we can go and we can listen to the small child and play the scales on the piano, and instead of being spiritually disconsolate because of the inharmonies, we can suddenly develop a tremendous spiritual regard. We can begin to estimate the difficulties, the struggle of this child, and we're with them every minute. They do not have to be of one level or another to be friendly, to be understood, and to give us association, friendship, and understanding. Frequently, we learn the most from those most different from ourselves. It is the heart in us that makes us willing to learn, to love to learn, and be ever grateful for the numerous experiences that come to us from different levels. These are the attitudes which help to keep us right. And with such attitudes, this problem of isolation does not come in. You may say that some people are not suitable, but it is not because of our spiritual problem that they are not suitable. The unsuitable person would also be unsuitable to us if we did not have any specific spiritual aspirations. It is not due to the spiritual aspiration problem. It is simply due to the fact that some people have in their way of life interests, attitudes, addictions, which are strange to us and which we feel no need for. These people perhaps are not for us at the moment, but they are also not for us to condemn. But if we have enough interests in our spiritual questing, if we are well-balanced people, we will never be alone, because there will be enough diversity of our eagerness that there are bound to be persons in our world from whom we can learn and with whom we can share. It is when we have this one-pointed drive merely to become spiritual ourselves that we can be very lonely. But this is a loneliness due to the fact that we have isolated our own condition and falsely estimated it. Otherwise, this state of things would not be a reality for us, and certainly not a desperate one, as it is in a great many cases. Now, at the end of the first chapter, we begin a series of realizations with which these lessons are supplied. There is an appendix in the form of a realization in each of these lessons. And these realizations are things which we seek, more or less, to understand, not in the common sense of intellect, but in the more uncommon sense of taking them into a quietude and feeling them, not merely thinking them through. Now, in this quietude in which we feel them, there are two different types of quietude that may be developed. One is the actual quietude of the quiet room, in the quiet chair in the corner, the soft light of evening. Here we can muse upon the mysteries of life. There is also the kind of quietude that comes perhaps in a more busy association, a quietude in which an all-pervading silence is not available. This is a quietude of the suspension of decisions, the suspension of attitudes, and the effort to experience in a more congested area, perhaps on the streetcar or the bus going home, or waiting in an office, or almost anything, that we become aware of the interpenetration of worlds, that we become aware of the nearness of that value which we've always regarded as more or less distant. And in the first realization, we have the discipline of the individual reaching out toward the universalization of his own consciousness. Here we have the problem of the person beginning to realize, as he can and as he may, and according to the growing faculties which he possesses, this mystery. Not only he is not alone, not only can he never be alone, but more than this, he is not only a living thing, he is life. Actually, in the root of things, life is not similar or parallel, it is identical. And the search for universalization causes us to reach out into the common values of things. There is no fact, really, in our happiness. There is a fact only in happiness, which we may share with everything that lives, inasmuch as happiness is available to life. Happiness, universally available, is like fire, universally available, but only manifested when flint and steel are brought together or the match is struck. Thus, universality is the absolute identity of all life, and the fact that gradually it is possible for the human being to experience life beyond his own. This experience at first is theoretical. Later it is sentimental. Still later, perhaps, it is intellectual. But ultimately, as the results of the disciplines of yoga, it is factual. It is the gradual recognition that we are not friends, we are not brothers, we are not relatives, we are not strangers, we are not foes, we are one being. And because of certain lockness of insight, we have permitted this sense of oneness to be destroyed by the dividing elements of body reflex. By sensory perceptions, we are divided. By interior experience of consciousness, we are united. This is, at first, a highly theoretical point. There's no doubt about that. But it has certain practical values, both mystically and philosophically. For example, it gives us a certain mental or rational orientation. It gives us the gradual resolution, strengthening through time, to eliminate the concepts of difference, to eliminate most of the unpleasant conflicts which arise from our acceptance of the fact of difference. Religious differences are dissolved in religious fact. Racial differences are dissolved in humanity as one creation. As all forms of so-called inequality are finally reconciled in that quality which is the root of all things. And we are in the same position that Max Müller was in the religious level, when he said there never was a false religion unless a child is a false man. Thus, all things are the degrees of one thing. And to become aware of this is to let down certain resistances and to instinctively support in nature all processes which move toward unity. And to remove our support from all things which divide, segregate, or result in the mutual criticism or condemnation one person of another. So in this first realization, we seek to experience something more of the fact of one God manifesting as one life through one creation. That this creation may be infinitely diversified within itself, we accept. But this diversity does not destroy unity, but takes place within unity. So that things, many of them apparently different, are like the leaves, twigs, and branches of a tree rising from one root and supported by one trunk. All life is one life. All mind is one mind. All soul is one soul. And from this, we come into a new relationship with life, a relationship that is not biological, but is truly spiritual. We do not expect to perfect such a realization immediately, but in the course of time, we may be able to perfect it. Now, in the days when this book was first written, we had quite a group of people who were much concerned over the problem of karma. So I'd like to bring out just a few more reflections dealing with that theme. Karma was, to the Oriental philosophy, the idea of the inevitable relationship between sowing and reaping. The individual must think that all action leads to a compensatory reaction in nature. And we are also warned, in many works relating to metaphysical things, that the moment an individual tries to live better, he is confronted with a load of old karma, and life becomes well-nigh impossible. Well, there probably is a certain amount of truth in this concept, but I think we have misunderstood, and perhaps my own understanding has enlarged on this point since the time the book was written. The facts remain essentially the same. The implications are the same. In fact, they are rather well clearly stated here. But I think we can add something to the picture, which will make it more valuable. The individual who is going nowhere generally has an easy trip. They say that, and there's an old saying, I think it's of Slavic origin, that no one throws stones under the feet of a person who is not going anywhere. The motion of the individual, when it is in conformity with his world, or with the general direction of collective opinion, is naturally the least arduous. He drifts. Of course, he may drift on the rocks. But even that will be an easy, gentle drift until the crash comes. The moment, however, the individual takes hold of his own destiny, the moment he decides that he's going to live according to inner conviction rather than according to outer policy, he goes against the general currents of his time. The problems are not any bigger than they were before, perhaps, because problems around him do not change. He changes. But it is now a matter of value or importance to solve what was previously ignored, to accept what was previously disregarded or rejected, or to try to do things more thoroughly, more honorably, more intelligently than had previously been the policy. This may all be assumed to mean that things get more difficult. But the karmic action is within the individual himself. Once he believes something thoroughly, he must live it. And this requires a planned life, a purposed life, because the world around him does not share his common discoveries. Thus, he cannot depend as much as he did before upon the support of the errors which once sustained him along with many others. He now must chart a course. He must learn more. He must study more. He must be more observing and more thoughtful. These experiences are generally regarded as bad luck because they make the person work. They make him feel and accept the responsibilities of his conduct more completely than ever before. So the karma of growth is the fact that the individual who really is dedicated to principles has to live them. And what are the rewards of this? The rewards are far greater than the cost. Actually, there are no occasions in which spirituality, true spirituality, has ever come as a penalty. There is no case in which the person who is truly more and better can say that his improvement has gotten him into trouble. Well, what generally gets him into trouble is the opinion that he has improved, not supported by any adequate factual improvement, or the belief that the mere fact of growth is going to make it essential for him to be miserable. He can, of course, do a thorough job of it if he wants to. But actually, all true development brings with it a compensation of larger living, happier adjustment, deeper understanding that the individual would never sacrifice for one moment that which he has gained in order to regain the false values which he has lost. So the karma is simply very closely associated with the fact that the person who is following certain disciplines and has made certain conscious declarations of intent must live them. And if he lives them, he gains and grows and is happy. But if he half lives them and half objects to them, then I suspect he could have a rather difficult time. But it is not the fact that nature is punishing him for growing. It's the fact that growth is demanding more than worried allegiance. It is demanding factual allegiance. Now, there is in the third chapter here, there is a list of a method for grading, a self-analysis, by which we recommend that the person estimate his own nature. I like this thought. It came a little, perhaps, at a time when psychologists were few and far between, and the average individual was not of the opinion that he had to go under analysis to find out what was wrong with him. Unless he has really a serious psychic disturbance, and he may have, but unless it is a sincere and real one, he still does not need to go under analysis. Because until he loses his own internal sense of honesty as a result of tremendous psychic stress, he is still in the best condition of any living person to say what is wrong with him. He can say it, but he almost always only whispers it. Because he knows, but he hopes that no one else will find out. That is why we recommended in the beginning with this list of questions that you carefully answer all the questions and then destroy the list. Because if you think other people are going to read it, you probably won't answer it quite as fairly. So we suggested here through a series of questions divided into headings that each person grade his own disposition. Find out what is right and what is wrong with himself.
Well, I interrupt you, but that doctor had to go to the hospital. Two cars blocking one of the back.
Two cars are blocking a doctor?
Yeah, in the back here. Here's when he's in the hospital. It's a Ford SPK653 and a Union Chevy AWL322 and out the back here.
Well, if the friends who are blocking the car, the doctor has to get to the hospital, we'd better let him. It's possibly one of those, shall we say, maternity cases. And those will not wait. They are like times and tides. This list is rather obvious. The purpose is to grade the individual according to his own honest belief as to his own ability in these matters. And there are various ways in which the grading can be done. Perhaps one of the simplest is to assume that 10 as a unit constitutes full and complete the maturity or development of a faculty or power. Therefore, if you put 10, it means that as far as you know, you are perfect. This number would therefore be used very sparingly by the wise. Of course, you can always compromise and make 9.5 with a moment of befitting modesty. But if you are down to 5, it means you are half developed in that particular quality, or down to 1, that you are very poorly developed in that quality. Now, when you say, for instance, we take certain of these things, continuity, perseverance, thoroughness, tranquility, discrimination, and inclusiveness. Now, one friend has asked us what we mean by inclusiveness. The others seem to be rather clear, but that one seemed to be worrying them a little bit. Inclusiveness, in the sense that I intended it to be used here, signifies the experience of the power to bring things into patterns without leaving things out. You know the old poem, "I drew a circle and left him out"? I believe Markham was responsible for the poem. And this idea of inclusiveness means, can you appreciate, can you accept, not through dedicated allegiance, but can you acknowledge the right value and importance of things you know nothing about, or have never been concerned with, or have even felt were outside of your sphere of interest, or beneath your dignity, or things which you could say would not advance any of your own higher cultural projects. Inclusiveness means the ability to bring things together and to include everything, to sense, if not actually experience, the unities of knowledge the unities of value. Now, so that you will not be in the condition in which you will say, this line of activity is no good. That one is meaningless. This one is nothing but highly developed corruption. That gradually we take things in and find their total values. The more we can include, the more of God we can bring into focus in our own lives. For there is nothing that exists that is not part of the divine power. And anything that we leave out is something of deity left waiting outside the door. About the time of this particular problem, there was a considerable amount of agitation due to the coming of certain foreign teachers of other races and nationalities, and there were strong prejudices against these persons. And the answer to that is rather obvious, that at the time of the birth of Jesus, he was born of a despised people, considered as nothing and less than nothing, the least of the colonies of the Roman Empire, and a cause of nothing but dissension to Rome. He did not come of a great and fashionable party, but of a party left out. And anything that we leave out may in truth be the key to our own survival. So by inclusiveness, I mean this internal spiritual capacity to include everything, to find a place for everything. And if we cannot use it at the moment, to very gently and reverently just kind of keep it in suspension until such time as we may need it, but never to cast away any form of knowledge, understanding, or any aspect of life or nature, lest in so doing we cast away with it the very seed of truth. Then we have the emotional problems. And under that, there are personal harmony and control of appetites, control of affections, and so on. You can read the list. But the tenth one, again, has caused a little question. Control of the tendency to venerate. This, I think, is important. In Eastern philosophy, the disciple has much more tendency to venerate his teacher than there is in the West. But the danger that lies in veneration is the gradual and subtle increase of temporal authority over spiritual fact. To venerate means, to most people, to add too much of holiness to that which is not in its manifesting state totally holy. To venerate too much is to open the consciousness to terrible disillusionments. When we put people up on pedestals, they fall off. It is good for us to know that the idea that Jesus taught is essentially true. No one is good but the Father. This is a very important thing. We may have kindly regards. We may have respect. We may feel a great obligation or gratitude. But it is a mistake to worship any living thing. And to venerate too highly is to violate the concept that thou shalt have no other gods before me. And there has been a lot of hero worship in religion, which is not essentially good. It is worse for Western man than it is for Eastern man, because Western man, less critical, may venerate less wisely. And in our way of life, we do often overlook the human frailties of our associates, and in trying to enfold them in too much divinity, we make a very heavy burden for them and endanger ourselves. Therefore, the tendency to venerate should be under emotional control, so that it does not escape into a blind adoration, but becomes a simple appreciation, a simple respect, and a simple regard. If we can moderate this, then we are moderating an emotional excess that might otherwise get us into difficulty. I see that our time is up, so we'll have to continue next week, but we hope that this process and procedure will be of interest and help to you. Thank you very much.